communicate them to the public through blog entries to describe what the risks of the system were. We were able to work with Sony to help them develop and test the fixes for the system, and we eventually published an academic paper that described both what was wrong with the system in technical terms and attempted to draw out broader lessons that would help future developers and implementers avoid the same kinds of problems. So talking about the output, it's on a variety of fronts, both within the research community, communicating to the public, and working with vendors. What we would write would depend on what we found, of course, but the interesting things to write, the things that are the details that we need to communicate as scientists are the ones that people need to understand and fix and reproduce the problems involved. So does that answer your question?
I think so. Does it answer your question?
I think it if there's some way to come up with an explanation or to distill that into language that could be a further limitation on the exemption, it might be worth considering that. I would stress that on the credentialing issue, if you look at the people that signed the supplementary submission, it's mostly academics, and they're the ones that are asserting that they are chilled anyway. So I think that would be the focus of it. There are obviously a lot of other things you could do in this exemption to make it clearer. We don't even have a definition of security flaws or vulnerabilities, and I think we raised that point last time. There are a lot of things that could be done to make it clearer and narrower, but I would hope that you would conform it to the scope of the evidence and in terms of what actually has been shown about the existence of these, the need to circumvent in order to conduct this research and the likelihood that some non-infringing use would be impeded in the next 3 years if the exemption is not granted.
Well, and I think that's another good point. How far do we go with that language of security flaws and vulnerabilities? And one thing, a question, sort of specific question I had is in relation to the FTC event a month or so ago was that there was a statement, I think by the same party mentioned before, having to do with software companies or computer gaming companies aren't using DRM anymore, but that there was a new way of basically providing an authentication system, which seems to be at least a different form of protection. To what does those kind of authentication systems fall within this type of situation for security vulnerabilities or flaws?
Well, are they DRM? I think they probably fall outside the law's definition.
I think you might be talking about the new Valve service, and I think that was get into the details of that further in a post-hearing question, but I think that service was simply branded as not DRM in some kind of a marketing pitch. But I think subsequent analysis of what that system looked like, it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, and that, I'm pretty sure that was a DRM system that would fall under this. I think that was just a some kind of a marketing pitch.
Well, then, is there any way to really define the scope of what we're talking about that would be that would implicate security flaws, or is this really just doing any kind of checking with these categories of works that are protected?
Well, we could try to define security flaws. Of course, there are definitions for these things, and I think a reasonable definition of security flaws would can probably be found in the statute somewhere, maybe outside of the copyright statutes.
Yeah, I think there might be something in maybe the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or something like that. But
that might be.
We could look into that after the fact.
I think the important thing is to tailor the definition of security flaws to be wide enough to cover the kinds of problems that we see in other types of software. We're not asking to do any extraordinary kinds of testing that aren't done to discover faults in other programs today. We're just asking to be able to do the same kind of investigation on DRM software without having the risk of a lawsuit.
And the nature of the security flaws may not be revealed until the completion of the research. So we've got kind of an ex post, ex ante problem. If Alex does the research and then suddenly finds that the security flaws that he's discovered fall outside of the definition, then is he subject to liability? So to the extent that there's any limitation on that front, I think it needs to address that situation.
Rob, I would just suggest that this conversation we've been having the last 15 minutes exemplifies why this is the type of issue that Congress addressed in these exemptions, and Congress may yet choose to address it further, but this falls pretty squarely, I think, in the neighborhood anyway of a lot of these statutory exemptions, and I just would reiterate that the office needs to be extremely cautious, follow the path it followed until 2006, and I believe it was, in my view, bumped off that path because of the very what it felt was very strong and compelling evidence of an immediate problem. We don't have that here, and without that, I think it's time for the. I would recommend that the office step back, take another look at this, and see where its role ends and that of Congress begins. Where did Congress? How far did Congress want it to go?
There is an immediate problem, and that's why I'm here, because we really do feel a chilling effect within the research community. But if I can point out something that has changed since the DMCA was passed, is that when the DMCA was conceived, we didn't yet have this idea that DRM technologies themselves would pose an elevated security risk. This is an idea that was only really fully formed after we saw what happened with the Sony rootkit. Then people, security experts, started to say, wait a minute, these technologies are doing things that are different from normal application software, and they seem to be presenting unusual levels of risk. So when the DMCA was written, this may not have been a category of security testing that Congress had in mind. So it's not surprising that the existing exemptions at least do not seem to directly match the structure of the kinds of problems that we've seen.
Well, I beg to differ with that. I think you need look no farther than 1201I to see that Congress was well aware in 1998 that bad things could happen through the use of technological protection measures, in this case, surreptitious collection of personally identifiable information, and so they provided a remedy for it. Yes, I'm sure they didn't anticipate the Sony rootkit, but I think they did anticipate that there could be problems and that there should be a way to fix them, and I don't think that that's at all excluded in the way 1201G, 1201J, and these other exceptions are drafted.
Okay, Steve, my notes tell me, and I have a vague recollection at this point, that toward the end of your opening remarks, you said something that, if my notes are accurate, I didn't follow it, so maybe you can either tell me notes aren't accurate.
Maybe I didn't either. So.
Well, I was going to say, it may be too long after you said it for you to be able to explain to me what you meant. Let's give it a try. You said there's a disconnect between the exemption and any non-infringing use of a word.
Yes.
Okay. Can you elaborate? I wasn't sure I was following what you were
saying.
This
actually goes back to the beginning of my presentation when I suggested looking at pages 12 to 13 of the submission of the proponents here.
The original proposal.
Yeah, the original proposal. In which, of course, they had to identify what is the non-infringing use that's involved here. And thank you. So we enumerate in this section two non-infringing uses of the proposed classes of works. All right, adversely affected. So one is engaging in good faith computer security research. To simplify this, let's just say we're talking about video games, because that's part of the class of works anyway. So what what is the non-infringing use of a video game that is involved in good faith computer security research? To me, there's a disconnect there. And then installing and utilizing the works, clearly people aren't prevented from installing their video games because of the DMCA. So I'm just not sure what the connection, again, in the analysis we've been walking through on exemption after exemption, we first look at what is the non-infringing use that is allegedly impeded.
Okay, well, let's take it from page 12,
yes.
13, as you referred to. What's described here, the first thing they describe is engaging in good faith computer security research.
Yes.
So
that is a non-infringing use, but it's a non-infringing use. Is it a non-infringing use of any work that's protected by its access control?
I heard a yes over there. Let's get an explanation.
I mean, I'm at a loss to explain how you could perform security research on a TPM surrounding a work without using the work itself. I mean, unless we're coming up with a particularly narrow definition of the word use, this seems pretty obvious to me, Alex.
Maybe I would need to install the video game on my computer and run the video game, etc. And aren't these non-infringing uses that are?
Well, that I think maybe to your second point you were talking about. We're talking about the good faith computer security research. So I guess the question Steve is posing is, on a close reading of the statute, is your good faith computer security research, which may in a vacuum be a non-infringing act, is it a non-infringing use of a work or of the work in question, or to be more precise, a non-infringing use of a particular class of works?
Well, we're falling within a particular class.
I mean, we can't very well do computer security research on the product while it's sitting in the box. It needs to be put into the computer. As Alex said, it's going to get installed and used. And I think that's distinct from our second instance of installing and using, where we're talking about users that are chilled because of the security issues on a particular piece of software from using that software. The joint commentators have pointed out in one of their limitations that, in fact, one of the remedies may be to simply delete the software. So that's the sort of installation and use we're talking about in that context. In the security research context, we're talking about installation and use that's necessary to perform the security research. So
you are, your position is you are using that work, you're using the particular computer game when you are performing the security research on the DRM that's attached to it.
Yes.
Okay. Correct.
All right.
The question is, are you doing it when you circumvent that access control? You get in the door.
Right.
Are you then doing anything inside the house? That's and probably more particularly
inside the house. What do you mean?
Well, you've circumvented the access control. You've gained unauthorized access.
Mm-hmm.
Now what? So that's the question. And I think the other way to look at it is this the kind of use that Congress had in mind when they said we want the Copyright Office and the Library of Congress to look out to make sure the non-infringing use is being protected? I don't think so.
One reason we have this rulemaking that Congress wasn't quite sure what kind of use it had in mind, that's why it left it to us.
Well, that's true. But usually you would, I just think this is distinguished from a lot of the other things we've talked about because it doesn't really, it seems to me you're breaking the lock, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're doing anything with what lies behind the lock. That's the concern. Maybe that needs to be more clearly defined. As far as installation and use, I think what I just heard is that people are chilled by the DMCA from installing and using the game because there's a prohibition on circumventing the access control. And I just don't think there's any evidence of that.
Okay. So may I respond? In terms of, to get back to the question of how, whether there is non-infringing use involved in the research, I'd like to first refer you to the research plan document that that I submitted, which I think details many of the steps that would be involved in actually studying these security questions in a system.
But just to give some examples, things that we might need to do to test the system involve, well, let's say we found a problem like the Sony rootkit, and the in that case, the fix that one of the fixes that we tested and developed involved removing a component of the DRM system, namely the rootkit itself that was causing the harm. It's like cutting out the tumor in the DRM software. And in order to develop and test this fix, we actually had to remove the rootkit, thereby circumventing a part of the DRM, and then use the system to see to test whether it was then secure. So if using the system after following that circumvention and making, say, running the software, making copies in RAM, all of that is not a use of the work, then I guess I don't really understand.
But, excuse me, wasn't the work in question there the sound recording? Were you playing the sound recording?
I think we needed to test whether the disc was still playable. I mean, what good would the fix be if it then rendered the sound recording totally useless?
Okay, but when you're talking about analyzing the code and so forth, that's the software, the DRM itself, and clearly this proceeding is not about non-infringing use of the DRM.
Well,
it's about non-infringing use of the work that lies behind the access control.
We're talking about testing, investigating, and correcting problems. And
aren't there reproductions and made in the course of that testing?
Things like temporary copies in RAM, yes. Installing
that's
the software
that's
onto
a use, right?
Pardon me?
That's a use. I mean, and potentially
non-infringing
use,
yes.
If it's for a legitimate purpose.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. I assume you've read the analysis we did 3 years ago when we recommended the exemption that you asked for. Have you read that recently?
Depends on to what extent, but yes,
okay,
hopefully.
Well, you probably read it more recently than I, because I probably haven't read it in the past 3 years. But let's go my recollection, because Steve's characterization, let's assume for the moment that Steve's characterization of what was going through our minds when we made that recommendation is accurate in the following respect. We had evidence of a real problem, a recent problem, that everyone agreed was a big deal, a big problem. We had a situation where we had a statutory exemption that may or may not apply. It wasn't entirely clear. And in the face of all that, we concluded certainly, because Steve wasn't quite as sophisticated in his arguments 3 years ago, I've forgotten about them. We didn't have the benefit of Steve's analysis of what the non-infringing use of a particular class of works was, so we didn't have to deal with that. So we thought, fine, you've got a non-infringing use, we've got a real problem, and we got an ambiguous statutory exemption that you may or may not be able to take care of. We got something we really need to worry about here. Let's just deal with it, give you a free pass, essentially, to fix it, and there we are. 3 years later, we're in a situation where the whole point of this rulemaking, as we understand it, is to take a look at the marketplace every 3 years, see what's going on out there, and deal with what's going on now. It's not our job to legislate. It's not our job to put into place permanent exemptions. It's our job to say what are the problems we are facing now or that we know with some degree of certainty we're going to be facing in the next 3 years, and let's deal with those. We don't have a record this time, I would suggest, that's anywhere near like the record we had 3 years ago, and I think we're all grateful for that. The rootkit is quite a few years in the past now. So we've got two examples you have, one of which I think is a situation where there are allegations. We don't know whether they're accurate. Another is one where there is apparently a problem. But I have to say, having read the submissions on this particular proposal, I don't have a clue what the facts are. All of the submissions on both sides to be incredibly thin in terms of informing me what the heck it is we're talking about with this. What is it called? Secure lock or whatever.
Safe disk.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a clue. I had a pretty good clue about the rootkit. I mean, I couldn't have technically explained it at all. But 3 years ago, I understood it was a problem. I understood something about the nature of problem. I understood the harm. No one's given me a whole lot of information as to what the problem is here, the nature of it, the extent of it. And while Steve has told us that the problem was solved, I don't quite understand by whom or how or under what circumstances. So I'm at a sort of a loss on the record in front of us to evaluate the nature of the harm that we are facing right now. And in evaluating the state of affairs today and the likely state of affairs in the next 3 years, I've sort of got to look at what the evidence is in this snapshot we have right now. And the snapshot right now is incredibly blurry to me. So anyone who can help me, I'd be grateful.
Well, I would be happy to talk about SafeDisk in more detail if you would like, but I'd also like to talk about the other example that we are trying to bring to your attention, that is the Securom system, where the facts are blurry, there's a lot of uncertainty, we can't say much to you, and that's precisely because of the problem that we're pointing out, which is the chilling effect that the DMCA is having on security research. So I would posit that the evidence is there right in the fact that this is blurry, that we have a problem that needs to be addressed.
I think the other thing to point out is that the rootkit was the first example that you saw, and then you saw SafeDisk, and now we see this blurry situation with Securom. Take that with the assertions that you've had over the past several days that the use of DRM is absolutely necessary to enable a lot of business models, is going to continue extensively. We've talked a lot about Hulu. Adobe is poised to add DRM to the Flash player. The use of DRM in the delivery of content is only going to increase. And I think when you look at that with the idea that DRM is going to have some endemic security issues, which those researchers pointed out in the letter, you see a pattern developing. And so not only do you have the issue with Securom right now, you have an extremely high likelihood that it's going to happen again, and it's going to happen a lot in the next 3 years. And I think that's important to address as well.
I guess the pattern I see is, I see the rootkit thing, which is 4, 5, 6 years ago, I don't know. And then, where does the pattern go after that? Well, we've got Securom, we've got SafeDisk, which, as I said, are pretty blurry. If I'm trying to find a pattern, arguably I need to see a little more than one thing that everyone acknowledges was a disaster several years ago. Hypothetically, we might have had a record today where everyone who came to us would say, gee, nothing's happened since then. At which point, I think it would be very hard for anyone to persuade us we need to do anything. What we have now is something somewhere in between that and another disaster. We've got some allegations of problems, one of which is nothing but allegations, and another one of which is people assuring me there's a problem, but not really telling me what the problem was, not giving me any details whatsoever, I think. Now, I grant, there are some footnotes, and I didn't follow the footnotes to the source. Maybe that lays it out in great detail. But in what was presented to us, all I picked up from it was, hey, there's a problem out there. And what I picked up from Steve was it got fixed. Okay, but I don't know enough to make any evaluation on either side. I can't evaluate your assertion of the problem. I can't evaluate your assertion it was fixed.
May I give you more information?
Yeah, I'd love it.
Let me tell you some more about the SafeDisk problem. So the SafeDisk DRM system made use of a component that was distributed with Microsoft Windows, and the purpose of this component was to allow SafeDisk to do low-level things with the computer hardware that would not be normally permitted by the operating system security model. This was something that the DRM system used in the process of inspecting copies of a game CD to make sure it was original. I believe that was the extent of the purpose of the component. So it was a DRM function that this was executing. But the way it was implemented had a programming defect where it did not check whether a particular input provided to it by the other running software on the system was correct. And as a result of this, a malicious piece of software, if it was installed on the system while with the SafeDisk component, could use it to also bypass the operating system security functions, to execute its own program within what we call Ring Zero, or you might hear this called kernel mode in other sources. So it was very much in some ways parallel to the rootkit problem. Someone who already has some access to the computer can use this to bypass the rest of the security system. That was the case with the initial rootkit problems as well. That's why neither of these problems directly allowed remote access to the computer. We later found out that other components of that Sony had used on their CD copy protection did. Specifically, their uninstaller programs opened up a backdoor. But the severity of this problem and the severity of the rootkit on a machine-by-machine basis were comparable. And the safe disk problem affected a much greater number of machines.
And in the real world, as a practical matter, was that problem exploited? And if so, in what respect, and what were the consequences?
I must admit that I don't know whether we have a complete record about how it was exploited. I'm not sure that there has ever been anything published about the extent of it. We may never know. But what we do know is that the bad guys found it first and were using it to attack people, and that's how it was initially discovered by security professionals who later published about it and helped fix it. But we know that the bad guys were using it to attack real users. That was the start.
David, could I tell you what I know about this, which is a lot less than what Professor Halterman knows? But I did read the bulletins that Microsoft issued about this. They stated that it's a driver that's installed with Windows, but it remains inactive until it's invoked by a game. So you have to be running a game, as Professor Halterman said. It's helping to check the authenticity of the game. There was a vulnerability. It was exploited at least once because it came to people's attention. It can't be exploited by a remote user. This, I think, is a big difference from the rootkit situation. An attacker must convince a user to run an executable or must have valid logon credentials to exploit this vulnerability, according to Microsoft. In his submission, Professor Halterman refers to this as a fiasco. The evidence is that it was a problem that was not discovered until someone had made malicious use of it. I don't know how extensive the malicious use was, but then it was relatively quickly resolved by an update to the operating system that Microsoft sent out and that they encouraged people to update at their earliest opportunity. It was apparently, I'm aware of two security firms that were involved with this Microsoft and a Danish firm. They have boards where these they have sites where these vulnerabilities are discussed and patches can be distributed. The Microsoft said it was an important problem. It was the second. It was not their highest severity rating, but it was lower than that. I think they have four systems, and I think the Danish firm has a four system, and they gave it its second lowest rating, less critical. I'm not in a position to judge whether those were the right evaluation or not, but the people that are experts identified this problem. I think I would not characterize it as a fiasco, and I would certainly think it's quite readily differentiated from the rootkit.
How can anyone tell me whether Microsoft and this Danish firm had to violate Section 1201A1 in order to do what they did to fix the problem, analyze and fix the problem?
Not potentially.
I honestly can't say, but potentially.
Well, you may be the person who's in the best position to help us on this. Yeah. I mean, in order to figure out the problem and to resolve it, would they necessarily have had to circumvent access controls, or would there have been another way to do it?
trying to think of another way to do it.
Well, let me get back to
you. Okay, and I don't want to put you on the spot. The fact that you had to think about it for a while may tell us something right away, but okay.
Maybe all I've got right now.
May I ask one question?
Yeah.
What is it about, this is limited to just DRM or these particular categories that are on personal computers. What is it about the DRM on personal computers that sets it apart from other security issues?
We have the most evidence that of security problems occurring in DRM software on personal computers. So for one thing, we tailored it to attempt to fit the facts. Secondly, the security side effects that DRM has are more pronounced or most pronounced when it's implemented in software on personal computers, because that is where these factors that I talked about of complexity, of needing to take on a certain amount of control of the computer, that's where these come into play. If you have DRM that's implemented, say, in a DVD player, then that's not going to implicate the security of your other data because it's separated from your computer. If you have DRM that's implemented, say, in a Blu-ray drive that is used as a computer peripheral, then the software in the drive is, again, in a certain way, isolated from the computer. It can implement protections without having to compete with the user for control and administrative understanding of the operation of the computer.
So that, in some way, goes to the depth of the DRM within the computer and the kernel.
Yes, it goes to the this tension that that seems to exist between implementing DRM entirely in software and having it be strong, and things like the complexity of the system, that implementers of DRM entirely in software tend to resort to very complex measures. They tend to have to limit the user's ability to understand what's going on in the system, as the rootkit was directly designed to do this. But those things are not necessary if you're implementing DRM outside of software. So I don't think there is, that we know today, a reason to conclude that there are endemic security risks to DRM implemented in other forms that is not implemented in software. Now, this may change in the future if we have the opportunity to study it. The problem, as I see it now, is one that is primarily one of DRM software.
And given that depth and complexity within the operating system, then is that something? I mean, it seems like it basically can integrate into that other computer program, the operating system. In order, this goes back to that same question, and if you can't answer this now and can answer that when in getting back to us on it, but to what extent, and this was an issue with the rootkit too, to what extent can the owner of the operating system, like Microsoft in this case, simply create a fix that deletes those particular portions, or to what extent does this involve some kind of use of the actual work itself? So if you can...
So the owner of the operating system, Microsoft, could produce a fix, and they did produce a fix to the safe disk component, but I'm not sure about the exact facts in the safe disk case about what they would need to test. But in cases like the Sony incident, they certainly needed to test whether the software was still functional after they deleted the rootkit component, and that would necessarily involve circumventing the DRM themselves. And I think it's likely that they would need to do something similar in the safe disk case in order to test whether the fixes they put in place left the games involved in a functioning state, or whether it rendered them unusable. So the circumvention comes up in various points in the research plan, but the thing where even the operating system vendor, if they were just told there was a problem here, they would still have a duty to their customers to test the fix that they were rolling out to make sure that it was functional, to make sure it didn't do more damage than the original bug. And that's a case where, as I talk about in the plan, circumvention may be necessary.
And any questions?
No, I'm good, thank you.
Chris? Well, I think for now that does it. Good chance you'll get some follow-up questions from us once we've absorbed all of this. Thank you very much, and we resume tomorrow morning at 10 again, is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's like getting out early for recess.
You don't have to come till later.